Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Pleased to be here and to have across the table from me Dr. Bart Colt. And every time I try to grapple with the Dutch language, I'm told, oh, please don't. You speak English so well, and your attempts at Dutch are somewhere between laughable and nauseating. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
You pronounce this as if you were a Dutch person, so I should compliment you on that. And I would
going to forbid you to do that. No, keep on going. What else do you have nice to say about me? Do you like my hair?
No, I would like to excuse on the part of all Dutch people who do that, because it's a complaint that many foreigners living in Holland have about their attempts to learn Dutch, that they don't get a chance.
We don't get a chance, and that leads to frames of mind such as dismissing Dutch as a charmingly misspelled version of English. It's wrong. It's just so wrong, and yet I do it. Anyhow, we're delighted to have you here, Bart.
Thank you.
And to give us some information on MASLD. What does that stand for?
It's an acronym which stands for Metabolic Dysfunction Associated Steatotic Liver Disease.
Metabolic Dysfunction Associated Steatotic Liver Disease.
Indeed.
One of my teachers, when I was coming up in pathology, said, Alex, the diseases never change. We just change the names and apply for additional funding. To what extent does that phenomenon underlie this shift in nomenclature?
I think that finance was definitely not the main driver of these changes. There were very good reasons to want to change the nomenclature from non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, NAFLD, the term which has been actually established by a pathologist in the 80s.
Jürgen Ludwig, say the name, say it loud and proud. Okay.
That's it. So that was Jürgen Ludwig, from Mayo Clinics. Yeah.
Yes, trained in, I believe, between Leipzig and Dresden, and emigrated after the Second World War. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And, there were multiple reasons why this name was unfortunate or has become unfortunate, and also why this disorder, defined as a histopathological disorder, nowadays doesn't fit with daily practice anymore.
Go on.
It has become an endemic disorder. Nowadays, one out of three adults, one out of seven to eight children is affected. And you don't do a liver biopsy on one third of the adult population.
I protest that as a histopathologist specializing in the liver.
I was afraid you would do
How
so.
How am I going to get my boat if I don't? Anyhow.
But I think that there is a majority among physicians, and there was a strong opinion that that doesn't really fit anymore.
Indeed.
with daily practice.
Yeah.
And that was unfortunate. And the other very unfortunate part is that it has been defined as a diagnosis of exclusion. And if you have an endemic disorder, and before you can diagnose it, you have to exclude all kinds of rare disorders, that doesn't really make sense. And it also doesn't make sense that if you have steatosis, you're obese and you have insulin resistance, but you also have hepatitis B, then that, according to this definition, you would not be able to say that this person has MASLD or NAFLD at that time, but MASLD plus hepatitis B, because that is something which occurs now in practice because the disorder is so prevalent. So there were several reasons.
I'm going to take issue with this because...
Okay.
When I approach a liver biopsy specimen from a child who has abnormal transaminases over a relatively prolonged period of time and whose sonogram looks as if there's some fat in the liver, I always have to remember there's no reason why a child can't have both Wilson disease and what used to be called NAFLD. And I don't understand the logic in excluding somebody who happens to have picked up a viral disorder along the way from assessment for and treatment of his or her MASLD. Is that one of the reasons that we've moved away from NAFLD and now we call it MASLD now And calling it Mansell lets us redefine the criteria for assigning that designation. Is that true?
Well, that's important to note. It's not just a name change. It's a change in the nomenclature and also a change in the definition.
That's the point I'm making.
And yeah. I think you're very right that in practice, of course, you would nowadays make a dual diagnosis, but the definition didn't provide in that yet.
Didn't permit that.
Mm-hmm. That's the reason, yeah.
And so that meant that in prospective studies, retrospective studies, if you came across patients who had fat and had something else, that they were no longer eligible for consideration. What do you do in a situation which must be fairly prevalent, at least in first world populations, of fat plus an acknowledged history of drinking alcohol? I know that this doesn't really apply to pediatric patients, but just as long as we're here, it seems almost ludicrous, except in the very oldest of pediatric patients, even to consider that non-alcoholic is part of the criterion. But so it seems to be. How do the adults handle that particular distinction?
Well, that was also one of the problems they encountered in practice, that, people who are of obesity or insulin resistant would often also be drinking alcohol like everybody.
Right.
And or almost everybody.
Well, I knock back a gin and tonic every once in a while, and I'm certainly fat. So,
well, that's correct. So, it was problematic that people who drank a moderate amount of alcohol, which would not add up to the diagnosis of alcohol-related steatotic liver disease, would be excluded from particularly studies. Because studies would only be performed if people drank a very, very, very limited or no alcohol whatsoever. But then this study population did not represent daily life, where a majority of people would probably consume at least a moderate degree of alcohol. So also, if you read this paper in this new nomenclature, there is an extra subgroup under the overarching term of steatotic liver disease of having MASLD plus moderate alcohol use, mm-hmm, as a specific distinct category, mm-hmm, which also allows this group to be studied and to be evaluated, yes, for new drugs in development.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the very important key points from the adult perspective, where the old definition and nomenclature did not allow to do that. And now it's clearly defined that this is also a group we should study. And that's, I think, a very important positive point about these changes which have been made.
But one of the reasons put forward, with which I have a little bit of trouble, is the idea of stigma. There's nothing like claiming a term and making it one's own to eliminate stigma. Fat. Maybe nobody likes to be called fat. Maybe the first reason to call it steatotic liver disease was to hope that nobody would understand Greek and that steatos would fool people. But that didn't work with idiot, moron, imbecile, which became mentally retarded. Kids on the playground just say retard now. There's no permanent solution in shifting the names. The only really permanent solution is to say, you have a disorder in which your liver accumulates fat. That's not normal. It's a signpost of something wrong with the basic chemistry of your body. And whether that something wrong is from the outside, as with alcohol, or excessive quantities of fried chicken, really, fried chicken poisoning used to be one of the terms used to designate the overweight when I was in medical training. Or whether it's something along the lines of Wilson disease or tyrosinemia. All of those are fat. Why is it so important to remove terms that refer to fat from designations of disease?
Yeah, well, I think you have a fair point in saying that changing names only might have a temporary effect.
It just shifts the curve a little bit, kicks the can down the road.
Maybe so, maybe so. However, patient advocacy groups really indicated that in their experience, it was stigmatizing, or at least it was not helping people accept this disorder and communicate about this disorder.
He wants to help me, but he talks to me about my disease in a mean way.
Apparently.
That's how they felt, huh?
Yeah. Okay. And if you can remove stigma...
Stigmata,
I think that... That's helpful, and there was discussion in this Delphi consensus group about, yeah, well, how big is this stigma, or is it big enough to allow a change, and how big should the stigma be before you come into action? But actually, the final consensus was, if you can remove stigma, that would be a benefit. And as you say, it might be kicking the can down the drain, but from a patient perspective, it was considered important
for those patients here and now who are hearing the words, it matters. I have a particular loathing for people who say, that's just so woke, that's so politically correct. Both of those terms, woke, politically correct, are only synonyms for, that's so kind. That's so caring. That's so thoughtful of other people's emotions and sensitivities. And of course, we being who we are don't care about another person's emotions and sensitivities, and we're going to call it fat. So congratulations on moving away from fat. And although I think that steatosis is a safe arm's length distance from fat, at least for most people, why the heck not if it's going to make people feel better about doing something to counter whatever the effects of that disorder are. I suppose I should say, thus endeth the Mass, because that really was a bit of a sermon, wasn't it?
We have to kind of go. I didn't fully understand your question.
And And I suppose I have to say now, thus endeth the Mass, because that was really a little bit of a sermon, wasn't it? Anyhow, go in peace.
Tell me how
what sort of acceptance is the new designation finding among our colleagues?
I think there's quite broad acceptance, and I think that the people who initiated this whole nomenclature procedure should be complimented, because they really try to include a wide range of people geographically, from different medical specialties and also other stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So a very, very large group was involved. It was over 250 people.
Good Lord.
Still, there was underrepresentation of people from some continents like Africa, Middle East, and Southeast Asia. And I think quite unfortunately, recently in the Journal of Hepatology societies from Sub-Sahara, North Africa, and Middle East state that they would not endorse this new nomenclature, and they would like to, or they stick to the MAFLD nomenclature, which was published a year earlier, and which was not really based on a large consensus, but rather a group of specialists who did so.
What were their reasons for dragging their feet?
Well, they say that they did not agree on the fact that fatty was considered stigmatic, at least not in their societies. And they also argued that the MAFLD criteria are too broad, and that the MAFLD criteria, which are a bit stricter, are identifying more severe patients. But actually the reasons for these diagnostic criteria to be so broad is exactly because at present only 5% of adults with MAFLD are diagnosed, and that's actually because the criteria are too complex and too limited. So that's a different point of view. But I think it's unfortunate that it's not embraced by all medical societies. but it is broadly accepted, and I hope in due time the people who still
they'll come around. They'll come around. In the 19th century, a word for a phrase for "you're looking so healthy" in Japan, in Japanese, back when people had tuberculosis and not enough to eat, was "ma yoku koeteru ne." Yoku koeteru. My, you're putting on weight beautifully. Meaning that you must be doing well in life. Hmm? And you're healthy, and look at that chubby little cheeks. Anyhow, so, and that now has become a phrase that one doesn't use in conversational Japanese, at least among the people whom I know, because nobody wants to be thought of as plump. I imagine that as economic conditions in these regions improve, and as social parameters shift to make being plump less acceptable than once it was, that the terminology will follow the northern half of the world's lead.
I'm still flabbergasted by your Japanese, which is as impressive as your Dutch, but I fully do, I fully agree, and I hope so, because I think it's important that there's a uniform way in which we approach it. So I fully agree, and I hope it will be like that.
Well, let's concede then that the shift in nomenclature is a shift for the good in many respects, but nothing is ever exactly what one would hope. Are there still weak spots, deficiencies, things that could be addressed in an updating or were left as a bit too difficult to handle?
Yes, I think there are. One of the first points is that if you look at this diagnostic algorithm, it starts with the suspicion or the signs of steatosis, but it has not really been defined exactly what we consider probable or accurate signs and symptoms of steatosis.
Let's talk about imaging studies.
Right. So it's mentioned that, for example, imaging signs of steatosis on ultrasound or MR would be sufficient. But if you go into ultrasound, it's well established that ultrasound is neither very sensitive nor very specific in detecting steatosis. And it hasn't been really defined, but that's also still very difficult because we still don't have very accurate, simple and non-invasive tools to detect steatosis. And for some of the new tools, for example, the elastography and the CAP modality we have there, we haven't really established very well the thresholds which have the best accuracy. So it's also a question we're not able to answer yet, but I think it's an important question because you can have a very good algorithm, but it really starts which people you think should enter into this algorithm to come to this diagnosis of MASLD. So I think there's still a lot of work in terms of research and also
data accumulation and analysis, absolutely.
Right.
What is normal and how do you recognize normal? And how do you recognize A, B, normal?
Right. And also if you, in this consensus statement, transaminases, for example, are not mentioned, well, in clinical practice.
That's what you use.
That's usually what you use. And can you only diagnose a patient with MASLD if he also has ultrasound signs of steatosis? But if he has an elevated ALT without signs of steatosis on ultrasound, you still cannot exclude that this patient has MASLD. So if you use this algorithm, you can come into situations where it doesn't really guide you enough to come to a diagnosis. And I think there's some work to do there still to help physicians to have a very clear entry point into this algorithm.
Should MASLD be a trigger for genetic analysis? And if so, for what sorts of genetic analysis?
Well, it's a very good point because in GPGN this month there is this position statement, a multi-society position statement by several pediatric hepatology societies, where we point out specific pediatric aspects. And one of these aspects is that in children, it is considered important to have a higher suspicion for other disorders.
Yes.
And there's a very good logic behind that, because inborn errors of metabolism more often present in pediatric age with, among other signs of steatosis, can be a presenting sign.
Right.
So there is a slightly adapted algorithm where there are more steps in between in children, where firstly, if there are specific signs and symptoms, you should really look further. And that also it's defined that there is a minimum set of other disorders you still should exclude. It doesn't make
such as Wilson disease.
Such as Wilson disease, autoimmune hepatitis, alpha antitrypsin deficiency. And it doesn't make it a diagnosis of exclusion. It can be then a dual diagnosis of these two disorders.
Sure.
But we feel that in children, you don't want to miss Wilson's disease, because missing this disorder at that age would be detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we feel that compared to adult population, there should be a higher suspicion of other disorders. And also with that, genetic testing could be included. It shouldn't be done in everybody, but there should be a suspicion that if there's features which are atypical, that these tests should be done.
Keep your threshold low. Always a good idea.
That's
Bart,
it.
Thank you. And why, look at the time. We have to move on to other aspects of our day. But
great.
Before we do, what song have you brought for us to listen to?
Well, actually, I brought a song which is a song by a folk singer from the Netherlands. He has died at the age of 50, but he's still one of the most famous folk song singers in the Netherlands. And it's a song where he talks to his small boy, giving him the wise lessons for the future. And it's a very tender and sweet song.
What's its name?
It's called Kleine Junge.
Little guy.
Little guy, right.
Okay.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Well, from this big guy to another big guy, that's you, Bart. And thank you for sharing your perspectives on this aspect of nomenclature and on fatty liver disease and its evaluation in pediatric people.
Alex, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.